the day. Forshee versus Neuschwander. Are you prepared to proceed?
Please advise them that I am participating.
Thank you very much. Justice Abraham's son is like the voice from the ceiling. Her chair is empty, but obviously she is on her cell phone and also on speakerphone for all of us. So we may hear from her from time to time. Thank you, Justice Abraham's son. You may begin now.
If it please the court, my name is Linda Coleman from the law office Spears, Carlson, and Coleman. We represent a group of property owners from the city of Hayward whose properties are part of the Pine Point subdivision located on Lake Hayward. In particular, our clients all own properties on a small private peninsula accessed by a single-lane private drive that ends at the property the Neuschwanders purchased in 2014. Our clients' properties, as well as the Neuschwanders' property, are all subject to a restrictive covenant that, among other things, prohibits commercial activity from occurring on these lots.
Counsel, do you agree that this is a plain language interpretation of a contract?
I do.
You do. And the operative language here is there shall be no commercial activity allowed on a lot.
Correct. Yes.
What commercial activity is taking place on the lot?
Both the circuit court and appellate court adopted definitions of commercial activity, dictionary definitions, that were almost identical in that viewed with regard to profit was from the circuit court or making or intended to make a profit.
Maybe I didn't make myself clear. We're talking plain language. I won't interrupt you again. I'm just asking, what commercial activity is taking place on this lot?
The Neuschwanders are offering the service of use of their property for money, in exchange for money, in much the same manner as a hotel or motel.
Okay.
Counselor, but you can rent this property. The circuit court found that rental of the property was not prohibited under the zoning ordinance, so you're relying on the covenant, correct?
Absolutely.
Okay, well, the covenant was put in place around 1982, when this subdivision was developed, but the house you're complaining about was the first property built, correct?
Correct.
And it was built by a corporation that used it for short-term stays, correct?
There is no evidence that that corporation ever used that property in exchange for money.
We're not talking about an exchange for money. We're talking about for short-term stays. We don't know if they charged or they didn't charge. Right?
Right.
And you don't know they didn't, and I don't know they didn't either.
There's no evidence that they did is all I can say.
Right, but there's no evidence they didn't either, correct?
I would agree.
Okay. So what we're trying to do is interpret what commercial activity meant to the people who agreed to put that restriction on their property. Now, why shouldn't we look at the first house built there that was used for short-term stays? Why shouldn't that tell us that having short-term stays is not commercial activity?
I would say that the evidence in the record does not reflect that there was anywhere near the amount of people, the number of people that are staying at this property now on a year, overnight, on overnight basis, and nor is there any evidence that anywhere near the amount of money that we're talking about in this case ever exchanged hands at that time. And I'd also point out
why does the number of people or the amount of money that changed hands affect whether commercial activity did or did not occur within the meaning of the restrictive covenant?
Because commercial activity, in order to interpret or in order to apply this restrictive covenant, the court is to consider the purpose of the covenant. And the purpose of prohibiting commercial activities to prohibit those things that are attendant to commercial activity, which would be increased noise, traffic, and strangers in the neighborhood.
Well, perhaps that would be attendant to it. But we are looking at what the people meant who put this restriction on their own property. Won't you agree with me that commercial activity could be many things? It could be running a restaurant out of the property. That would be commercial activity, right?
I would agree that commercial activity is any activity that is intended to make a profit.
Oh, any activity. Well, then how is it that the circuit court judge said, well, they couldn't rent this as they have been, but it's okay to do it for the weekend of the Berkey?
I would disagree that I would say it is a violation of the terms of the covenant to rent for any period of time. I would also point out that under
even long-term rental. So if the and wasn't it long-term rental before these people bought it? A trust owned it, and then the Neuschwanders bought the property, but the people that had it, the trust that had it, rented it at the time the Neuschwanders bought it, correct?
No, there's no evidence to that effect.
Oh, yeah. If you look at the offer to purchase, it says the tenants shall remove all their belongings from the property. Well, why would the trust have put that in if there weren't any tenants there? That's in the record.
To our knowledge, there is no evidence that there were any tenants in that property
well,
at any
what,
time.
Well, what about what I'm telling you, the offer to purchase? It's right there.
I suspect, Your Honor, that Chief Justice, that was put in the event that there were any tenants in the property, but there were not to our knowledge, and there's no evidence that there were tenants in that property or that payment was ever remitted for stays at that property in the past.
I'd like to go back to something the Chief Justice started asking about earlier. That's the Louisiana and Pacific, when they owned it. Is that when the restrictive covenant was put in on the lots?
There was a restrictive covenant at that time, yes.
Well, was it, did the restrictive, what I'm asking, I don't know the answer. Was the restrictive covenant created at the time L&P was operating their corporate retreat or whatever they were doing?
I believe L&P was one of the initial purchaser of the lot when this.
Well, they owned the whole point, or they owned all the land at some point, right?
I think at some point they did.
And then they subdivided it, they lotted it off, but they kept this piece of property for themselves, right?
At the tip of the peninsula.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so it would make sense. I didn't see it. If the record discloses it, I thought your response to the chief's question kind of assumed that the restrictive covenant was put in place at the time L&P was operating the corporate retreat. Is that true or false?
I'm not sure about the term corporate retreat. That's my only hesitation on this. I don't
what
know.
What would you like to call it?
It was the L&P property. And okay. I don't know when they used it exactly.
Which according to the briefs and the record that I read, was being used for entertainment of executives from around the country, potential customers, longtime customers. Yes, 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 right?
We don't dispute that it had been used for that purpose.
Okay, so it was used by L&P to cultivate a potential business, to maintain business relationships, to build goodwill among potential customers, and to keep goodwill with customers who were already extant. Yes?
I assume that those were some of the purposes. Yes, Justice.
But, counsel, do we look at the purposes? I thought that the text, the interpretive rule, is you look at the very words of the covenant and you figure out what those words mean. You don't look at what the parties have done with the property. You look at the words of the restrictive covenant, and the restrictive covenant prohibits commercial activity on the lot, right?
Right, Justice, and I'd also point out that under the rules set forth in Joyce v. Conway, the other property owners did take no notice of a violation of the covenant that's not especially offensive to them, well, and still maintain their rights to enforce against those that
are. If your answer to Justice Abrahamson is yes, then please reconcile your answer to the Chief Justice when she asked you, don't we have to look at how the first owners, at how the first people who own the property at the time the restrictive covenants were entered interpreted the words. You answered that yes. That's why I asked you if the restrictive covenant was entered into at the time when L&P was operating the property. I view this and I think corporate retreat, you call it whatever you want to call it. So please reconcile your two answers.
And I apologize if I was not clear. The interpretation of restrictive covenants looks only at the language of the covenant. And as cited by the Wisconsin Realtors Association in their brief, courts construe contracts as they are written, and it's not the office of a judicial tribunal to find a meaning that is contrary to the language used
in an agreement.
But we
look at the intent of the parties that put together the covenant, which is why I asked you what the person, the corporation who built this building thought it meant. I mean, they were the ones that put it together. This is not a term that you're going to find in a statute where we can look and see what did the legislature mean. This is what did the people mean who contracted to have this restriction placed on their property. So if you're going to look at what that meant, shouldn't you look at what it meant to the person who put it on its property? And here it was a corporation that was the first building built in this subdivision, correct? And that was about 1984, but in 1982, this restriction was put there. So one would assume if they built it and they agreed to the restriction, what they did was not in violation of the restriction, correct?
I would disagree on this point, Chief Justice. In the interpretation of restrictive covenants, we are not to look at the intent of the drafters other than can be ascertained by the terms of the covenant itself.
Okay, I think that you responded to Justice Gableman when he said, well, didn't they have, people in to spend short times? They had people from around the country to encourage their business. Your concern seems to be whether they charged or not. But I don't know if a company can entertain future customers, even though they don't charge them, why that's any less commercial than what was done by the current owners of the property. They entertained people, they charged them. Well, maybe the company that had it first charged them because they got business from them. Do you see what I'm having problems with, your answer, why I'm having problems with it?
I think I see why you're having problems, Chief
right.
Justice, but the terms of the restrictive covenant prohibit commercial activity. And so the inquiry for the court is, does this meet the definition of commercial activity?
But the problem is the term is ambiguous. You think it has only one meaning? It could not have more than one meaning?
I think it has an easily ascertainable meaning that both courts found. Both courts adopted a definition
okay,
that was
well,
almost
you,
identical.
You interpret a contract. I interpret a contract. This court will interpret it as a matter of law. So courts don't find what words mean in a contract. That's a question of law, what it means. And what we have to determine is what did the people who put it on this contract mean? What did they expect would be prohibited by what the restrictive covenant restrains? That's the question.
But courts are to look, they do look at the dictionary definition to define ordinary terms, which both lower courts did.
I'm concerned about what lower courts did, but this question is de novo for this court. It's a question of law.
I understand that, Chief Justice. And to that end, taking a 10,000-foot view of this case.
Okay.
Go ahead. She's in the middle of an answer, Justice Abrahamson. Just a minute. Go ahead and finish up.
Taking a 10,000-foot view of this case, it is really hard to characterize this use that we're talking about today as anything other than commercial.
Okay.
We're talking about hundreds of customers. We're talking about $55,000 in the first year of operation. We're talking about a property that was represented for the purposes of the IRS as a 1031 tax exchange, which means it cannot be a second residence or vacation home. It is for the purpose of profit. It had to be used for that purpose. We're talking about a property and a use that requires payment of sales tax. It would be very difficult, I think.
Counsel, I'd like to, I appreciate
Justice
your
Kelly, if I could bother you just a minute. Justice Abrahamson
was trying
to get in
course.
And I asked her to wait. Did you finish your answer?
Sufficiently, sure.
Okay. Justice Abrahamson, I'm wanting you to ask your question now. We'll wait for you.
I did ask it, and the question I asked is, what's the rule of interpretation? And I understand that the rule of interpretation is question of law. You look at the words of the restrictive covenant here, not the intent of the party. We don't care about that. What we care about is what do these words mean? And the words are commercial activity on the property. And it seems to me What does the word on mean? Was the commercial activity on the lot?
Commercial activity is activity undertaken for the purpose of profit. So any activity that is...
Very definition. We agree. Okay. Commercial activity on the lot.
On the lot, on the Neuschwander lot, a service is offered. That service is use of a premises heated with linens on the bed, just like a hotel or motel. That service is provided on the lot. The money exchanges hands elsewhere. When we booked our hotel to come down here and see you all, we paid electronically months ago. But that hotel is a commercial enterprise.
So, Council, I appreciated your emphasis on the text of the covenant. So let's turn to that. It seems to me, just to make sure that that I'm reading it right, I've substituted a couple of variables for the actual language, and then we'll get to its application here. So if we look at it, it says, there shall be no commercial activity allowed on any of said lots. So so let's say, to simplify this, there shall be no A allowed on B, right?
Right.
And so what we need to do then is figure out what we're substituting for A and B. And for A, it's renting of the property, correct?
Correct.
And B is the property.
Correct.
Right. So the restrictive covenant, if we do the substitutions you just agreed to, would read, there shall be no renting of the property on the property, right?
There shall be no exchange of use of the property on for money on the property.
Right. There shall be no exchange of use of the property for money on the property. So did that
You're defining commercial activity.
Just a minute, right? Justice Abrahamson. Yeah. Justice Kelly's asking the question. Go ahead.
So renting is exchanging money for the use, right?
Yes.
Right. So we're talking about renting of the property. So was there any renting of the property that occurred on the property?
Exchanging money for use of the property. The use of the property necessarily occurs on the property. I understand the point that the money may not have exchanged hands on the property.
Yes, but do you, my point in going through that exercise was to demonstrate the grammatical difficulty of getting to your resolution. I think that what you want is a restrictive covenant that says that the property shall not be put to commercial purpose. But that's different from describing the activity that occurs on the property, right?
I can see that there's certainly a difference in the actual language. I think that looking at the alternative, which is to say that this restrictive covenant says this lot shall not be used for the purpose of making money, except if the activity qualifies as something as residential in nature, creates all kinds of ambiguity.
Okay, let's follow this through with your preferred interpretation of this. So you say, this language would prohibit long-term leases of the property, right?
Yes.
Okay, and why is that?
Because it's a service offered, which is use of the property, in exchange for money.
Okay. Would that not also prohibit the sale of the property?
I would disagree.
I'm sorry?
No, I do not think it would prohibit the sale of the property.
And why not?
It's not an exchange of use of the property for money. It's exchanging the property itself for money.
Council?
Right. And some would say that a lease does the same thing. It's an exchange of money for using the property, right?
Not for owning the property, but for using it, correct.
You get a short-term ownership interest in the property. It's called a lease.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. So you've got a short-term ownership versus a long-term ownership. How long do you have to own it before it qualifies, before it escapes the control of this provision?
I wouldn't see a sale of the property as activity on the property. It is a sale of the property wholesale. You now own the property and control the activities that occur thereon.
So that's putting the property in commerce. So let's take a look at the actual activity that occurs once the transaction happens, right? So. When you sell the property, the owner goes and they eat there, right? They sleep there, they recreate there, yes?
On this particular property, yes, they use kayaks.
Well, yeah, you buy the property and that's what one does with such properties, right?
Depending on the property, yes.
Okay. And it's a residential property?
It's in a residential zone, yes.
And so you do residential things. You sleep there, you eat there, you recreate there, right?
Those are things you do.
Okay. So now let's change it. Instead of buying the property, you rent the property. And we look at the renter and we follow him onto the property, watch carefully what he does. Tell me how that's distinguished from what the buyer does on the property.
In this case, we have various groups of people at various times paying to use the property, paying to do things like use kayaks that are on the property. A property owner is going to use the property for their own purposes. Nobody's going to be paying them money to use that property. They might invite people.
Yeah. Hang on just a second. Just so I can, because what I want to do is I want to figure out where the problematic piece is for you, right? So tell me if there's any distinction between what a renter does on the property and what a buyer does on the property.
I don't know what the distinction would be.
Okay.
Ziegler is trying to get in to ask a question.
I'm just trying, it's of a similar nature to your questioning, but I understand today what your argument is with respect to renting the property. But what, if any, limits are clear on what you can and cannot do? If it's as simple as you can't do anything on the property for profit, so would that prohibit someone from running a babysitting service out of their home or selling Amway, having a cabbie party, deciding whether or not they want to work from home? Could be an accountant who does tax returns for other people from their home. How will people know for sure what the limits are as to what they can do on their own property, given your expansive definition?
You know, I think the case Bubles v. Dane County is instructive on that point, because in that case, the court talks about activities that are an incident to a property owner residing on the property would not be a violation. So if we look at, for example, somebody who's making dinner and gets a business phone call, their aim there is not to make money, their aim is to make dinner. But as an incident to living there, they're taking a phone call.
What if I make money selling things on eBay?
That's a closer question, I would agree, and it may or may not be an incident to living there. I would also point out that under Joyce v. Conway, if whatever activities you're engaging in are not especially offensive to your neighbors, they need take no notice of them.
What if I have a home office?
I again would say that that's probably an incident to residing in the home. I happen to reside in this home, and so occasionally I work from home.
I'm a realtor, and I list properties from home and take phone calls and keep an office. And I mean, where are the limits? I understand the notion of trying to have a clean definition, but if the definition is a service offered in exchange for money, that's tough. That's really prohibiting people from doing a lot of things in their own home.
It can, which is why I think it's really important for property purchasers to exercise due diligence in finding out easements, restrictions, and reservations of record. Pardon me.
Well, what about going from dovetailing on Justice Ziegler's question, what about the instance of, say, a disabled certified public accountant or a lawyer or a therapist who, perhaps see clients at their home, they can work via computer, Skype and the like, and so they're within the confines of their own residence, and they do charge for their services, but for reasons of their disability, or say they don't even have a disability, they just find it more convenient to work at home, would that be prohibited?
I would suggest that that may be incident to residing there, and I'd also say that that is very unlikely to be especially offensive to any neighbor who would seek the help of the court in enforcing an injunction
but
in
wait
that
a minute.
Situation.
Incident.
But the test can't be whether it's offensive to the neighbors or
right.
Not, can it?
Right.
Right. Where does that come from?
Well, practically speaking, that's when cases end up before the court.
Practically speaking, we're talking about the language of the covenant. You were talking for the last 20 minutes, 25 minutes almost, about the language of the covenant, and that's what we're asking about. And so I'm just asking, would these three people, who for one reason or another find it a convenient or a necessity, say, you know, they're older and for whatever reasons are confined to their house, but yet they still need to earn income, and they work from their home, and it's not like making dinner or something, that it's work. This would be prohibited.
Making dinner is work.
This would be, or something. This would be prohibited under your definition.
I agree that it could be prohibited, which again is why property owners need to be careful about the easements, restrictions, and reservations of record that they're buying into, because there are plenty of places with no restrictive covenants.
Well, it also could be that the person that puts the restriction on should make it very, very clear what it is that's being restricted.
And I would argue that if the drafters wanted exceptions, they should be clear about those exceptions,
well,
too.
Okay, that's fine.
I want to return.
Go ahead, Justice Breyer.
Oh, wait.
Okay. Thank you.
Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I am Ann Kearney, and I represent Lee and Mary Jo Neuschwander. I think we are on the same page with regard to what should be determinative here, and that is the clear and unambiguous words of the restrictive covenant. And those words permit short-term rentals. They permit short-term stays, as what happened in the Louisiana Pacific House, the LP House. They permit short-term rentals, as what's happening here when the Neuschwanders own the house. And the reason is both what's in the covenant and what's not there. When you look at what's not there, the covenant does not say that it needs to be owner-occupied. The covenant does not say that there is a prohibition on rentals. It does not say that there's a prohibition on rentals of under 1 year.
So, counsel, what does this restricted covenant prohibit?
Well, Your Honor, I think you and Justice Gableman, actually everyone, to some extent, looked at the on piece. And the on modifies activity. And so if you look at some of the case law from way back when covenants were really being looked at with regard to those sorts of words, what they're looking at is whether there's a trucking terminal on the property, whether there's loading and unloading of trucks, for instance, or whether there's a grocery store that's occurring on the property, where you have this. It's not just, it's a service. And the service isn't opening it up, that house or that property, so that somebody can step in the shoes of the owner to use it for residential use, to relax, eat, sleep there.
Okay,
it really is something different.
So we pushed Ms. Coleman pretty hard on the language and structure of the covenant. So
I was kind of glad to see that.
So now it's your turn.
Could I ask a threshold question on the language? Would you mind me coming in?
I will defer.
Thank you. There's been an apparent disagreement in listening to the questions from the bench as to how you interpret the language that Justice Kelly is going to be focusing on with laser intensity in a moment. And it's my understanding of the law that subjective intent with regard to restrictive covenants found in deeds is not part of the test of interpreting the language of the document. Is that understanding correct or incorrect?
Well, I guess, Your Honor, with regard to subjective, I think that's the issue. You do look at the words to see the intent of the drafter based on the words. And the extrinsic evidence piece of it, if that's how you determine what subjective is, that's true. We agree that that's not supposed to come.
Unlike other contracts, which were the basis of some questions from the bench, other contracts, you may look to the intent or subjective intent of the parties who entered into this language and wrote this language in.
I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the test is a little different when you're dealing with restrictive covenants in deeds. First of all, is the test different? Is my understanding correct? Is the test different when looking at restrictive covenants in deeds when looking at the issue of intent, different from the normal contractual approach?
Well, I agree that it is different in that extrinsic evidence doesn't come in, and that's the accommodation I think Chief Justice Rogozak wrote about in Solowitz, which is you've got this freedom of contract, you've got restrictive covenants, and you have to make them work.
And in fact, you look only at the scope and purpose as found in the words themselves. Is that correct or incorrect?
That is our understanding,
that's
Your Honor, of what's happening. And I think what's happening with regard to the LP issue, I think it's not extrinsic like the affidavit that was brought in with regard to the developer that came in the circuit court, and we challenged that on appeal, and the Court of Appeals said, you know, we're not going to deal with that. But the LP house just shows that there is room in the restrictive covenant for short-term stays,
yes,
and that happened.
I'm just focusing on how we are to view the intent of the language that we're now going to be looking at. And as I understand it, it's different than normal contractual interpretation of intent. Instead, we look at the scope and purpose as set forth in the words themselves.
That would be our understanding. And also, of course, what's not there.
Well, you know, what's not there is I'm going to go shopping this afternoon at pick a store. I mean, there's a lot of things that are not there, right?
Well,
we look at the words that are there.
Well, that's true, but what about this, Your Honor? I mean, there are, in mortgages, for instance, there are words owner-occupied, and there are words with regard to leasing that says, I mean, if we're going to make it clear, and if you don't want to have somebody lease it, you should say no leasing. Or you should say no rental for less than a year. Or you should say owner-occupied. That makes it the clear and unambiguous terms.
Is it?
All right, so thank you. So just jump back in real quickly. Is it fair to say that commercial activity can be defined simply as buying and selling?
We would say that if it's happening in this particular restrictive covenant, commercial activity on, it would be buying and selling on the property.
Okay. So in this restrictive covenant does not describe who's doing the buying and who's doing the selling, right?
That's right, Your Honor. But I think when you look at some of the cases from the foreign jurisdictions in particular, what's happening with the buying and selling with regard to what petitioners are talking about, they're looking at what's happening at the owner level. So there's something going on there where there's money exchanging hands. And I think when we look at the foreign jurisdictions and you look at Heath, you look at Harding, we're looking at what's happening with the tenants. What's the tenant use?
Right. So but before we get to that, I just want to make sure that I have an understanding of the extent of the actual language used. Because I think that there is, I'll just foreshadow where I'm going with this. I think the restrictive covenant can be both over-inclusive and under-inclusive. So if commercial activity is just buying and selling, then you know, does this prohibit an owner from bringing a plumber in to do plumbing work, buying and selling services, and it's on the property?
No, I don't think it about. I think because what we're looking at is the use. And I think buying and selling on the property is what is the use of that property happening. And I think you yourself talked about the fact that what's happening on this property is that somebody's living there. They're stepping in the shoes of the owner. So they're eating and sleeping and recreating. And frankly, if your sink backs up and if you're like me and you don't know how to fix it, you're going to bring somebody in. Mm-hmm.
But they're not really living there. They're staying there just like they would stay at a hotel. When I look at what, and I hit upon the words you used in your brief about how this is residential use, so I looked at the dictionary definition of what it means to reside, and I don't think it squares with your interpretation, because residing on a property means having your permanent home on the property. Well, nobody has a permanent home. But I kind of interpret that to mean I'm moving my stuff in and I'm going to be staying there for a period of time.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree with that. I think it is true that residential, we have this sort of contradistinction in the law, at least in Wisconsin law and these other foreign jurisdictions, residential or commercial. And so really when we're looking at what residential is, we're looking at, is it sort of the connotations of daily living? So, you know, what are you doing there, whether your possessions are there or not? And, you know, we don't really talk about the duration of it. Are you there forever? Are you there for a period of time? What we're talking about is what you're doing.
How do you distinguish that from staying at a hotel?
Well, a hotel, respectfully, is much different because you're not stepping into the shoes of the owner there. You have, you know, when you go to a hotel, you know that you're going in and there are going to be strangers all around you, and you're going to call down to the desk if you have a problem, and you're getting maid service and you're getting perhaps room service. Here what's happening is you are pretending like you're the owner in this house, this beautiful 4,000 square foot house, and you're pretending with whomever is there in your extended family with you that you're in this place and you own it for that short time, just like a lease, when you're taking possession as a leaseholder. And this particular restrictive covenant would allow for long-term leasing, and it would allow for short-term leasing, just like what's happening here.
I understood your argument to be focused in contrast to a commercial activity occurring on the premises, to be the activity that's occurring when the occupants are in the residence. They are doing exactly what you're describing. Justice Kelly went down the list. He fortunately didn't go through a comprehensive list of what people do in residences, but they use the facility as they would their own residence, plus presumably being familiar with the greater Hayward area and the lakes therein. They're going to use it for recreation purposes and to enjoy the outdoors and to enjoy the beauty of our northern part of our state. And so I did not take your argument to be that it is akin to or a substitute for a permanent residency, such as all of us presumably have a home that we return to and where we have no intention to leave from, but rather the activities that we engage in there are the same that we would engage in if we were to purchase the temporary right to occupy these premises, as opposed to if someone were to purchase the temporary right to occupy these premises and then start selling bait or selling product from the, or if the owners themselves were to start selling something where customers would come to the door and make a purchase and then depart. That is how I understood your argument. I understood it to be a setup as far as a contrast to commercial activity and related to the badges and incidents of residential, the hallmarks of residential life.
That's exactly your argument, Your Honor. It's two sides of the coin. And I think vacation homes themselves are residential use. You don't have to own that property to reside there. You can have a vacation home, and it could be residential use. Yes, Justice Ziegler.
As I understand your argument, it's that commercial activity cannot be defined as broadly as is suggested here because it would prohibit so many things. It runs contrary to the notion that you should be able to use your own property in a fairly free and unrestrained way. And because it is ambiguous, and because it is a restrictive covenant, it ought to be construed narrowly so that it doesn't run afoul of those fundamental principles involving land and property ownership.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. I mean, this is a fee simple estate. They have the use of the enjoyment of the property. The restrictive covenant itself should be unambiguous, and it is supposed to be strictly construed against the activities that are being prohibited. If Your Honors were to find, of course, that it is ambiguous, it's hard to tell what commercial activity is, then we still say the result is the same, that you would affirm that there is no prohibition here because, of course, the special rules that we have for restrictive covenants are thus that if you can't tell, if it is ambiguous, it should not be itself applied or enforced.
In other words, it's to be construed very narrowly.
Correct. I mean, either it should be construed narrowly. Here we're saying construed narrowly is the use, the nature of the use is residential. And so it doesn't fit.
The problem I have is this, so help me with it, if you will. How does your argument apply to Residence Inn, which are the Marriott version of extended stay facilities, or Home to Stay, which is the Hilton version of extended stay? I would be loath to say that Hilton and Marriott are not engaged in commercial activity. So how does your argument square with my premise, maybe you don't accept my premise that when Hilton and Marriott are running Residence Inn and Home to Stay, long extended stay facilities, that those are commercial. Why are those commercial and this not?
Well, I think it has to go with services. I mean, you're right. There is this whole spectrum or continuum about what's happening. But, you know, you have a company that has, and that's more like the hotel idea, and we know what hotel is. It's under the statutes. It's five or more separate, mm-hmm. you know, kind of living quarter rooms where you have all these strangers next to each other. And so I think that is still the residential inn thing, which is that, yes, you have some rooms. Yes, you're eating there, sleeping there, but you still are getting services from the entity that's running
it. What services are you getting?
Well, there is some maid service that comes in at some point in time. It may not be every day like your regular situation, but it is.
I've stayed at these VRBOs, and they can have maid service come in also.
But that's not what's mm-hmm. happening with this particular case, and so that matters. Let me back up a second
would it matter if that did happen?
Well, I think, Your Honor, what we're doing then is moving. I mean, I think these questions come into what's happening on the property. And so when it's room service or bed and breakfast where breakfast is being provided, then it looks more like services happening on the property, and it gets more towards commercial. But then I would say, frankly, it's pretty ambiguous what commercial activity means. And that would throw you into the situation where it can't be enforced because it's not certain what it is. And to your point, Justice Bradley, you do also have sort of the overlay of ordinances here.
Counsel, if I can interrupt.
Justice Abrahamson, answering Justice Bradley's question. Just a minute, and I'll get to you.
When
please
you're,
finish.
When
and
you're done, let me know.
Just
Thank
a minute.
You.
Just a minute. Okay, please finish your answer.
I'll make
to Justice
it quick.
Bradley.
I'll say that this is a residentially zoned area, so a residence inn would not fit within that zone because it would have to be either a single family or
single
two family.
Single family dwelling. 15 people can be brought here. Not a lot of families these days are 15 people.
Well, it's a multi-generational family, my understanding is. You know, you have a bunch of different folks. I mean, you're not going to want to be in a $4,000 square foot house with a bunch of people you don't know. What you have is an extended family situation here. And so it is a single family or a two family dwelling allowed in that zoning area.
Okay, I'm going to try to get Justice Abrahamson to have a chance. Now, Justice Abrahamson, we're waiting for you to ask a question.
Right. The word commercial activity are really not ambiguous. You can find them in the dictionary. The problem in this case is how do you apply them? You got different fact situations. Into the fact situations, how do they affect? And is that an ambiguity issue? And if that's ambiguity, then is there extrinsic evidence that was brought in or should have been brought in?
Well, I would definitely say that there should not be extrinsic evidence here. I'm definitely on that on that position. With regard to commercial activity, I mean, respectfully, well, first of all, I think it's commercial activity and we're dealing with on said lots. So we need to put them all together. That's what the wording is here. And I think commercial activity is susceptible to different meanings. And I think that's the problem with this particular restrictive covenant, which is if you're looking at it narrowly and you're trying to figure out what it means, the landowners here should not be in doubt. I mean, that's why we have clarity in restrictive covenants, because it comes through the chain of title, and it takes decades. I mean, people are bound for decades by this. And there needs to be some, I think, better than looking at a dictionary and getting two different types of explanations like the Court of Appeals did. You need to say what you mean. You need to say you want it to be owner-occupied like mortgages do. You need to say that there's no leasing. And when you do that, everyone's clear about it, and it makes sense what the parties are contracting for. And that did not happen here. And that's why it's not enforceable. And
so, Council, you would agree that renting the property is commercial activity, right?
Renting property is commercial activity. No, I don't think I agree with that, Your Honor, because
from the
renter
standpoint,
the nature of the use, what we're doing is looking at what is happening, the use of that property.
Hang on just a second. So I'm just going to take that phrase, commercial activity, and then we'll tie it up with on the property in a second. But the act of renting property, that is commerce, right?
Well, now that's a different issue than commercial activity, I would say. So is it the case that, as petitioners say, there's an exchange of money? Yes. And if you have an apartment building and you have a property manager there and you're renting the property, you couldn't do it in this residential zoning, yes, that is commercial activity. But when you back it up and you look at what's happening, you know, I think long-term rental can happen here. It happens in vacation homes all the time.
Right. So but the distinction is between that transaction and then what occurs on the property. Right?
Exactly, Your Honor. And that's the difference between what's going on with the owner and what's happening with the renter or the tenant.
Right. So the key here is the prepositional phrase, on the property.
That's true. I will tell you, though, that when you look at the foreign jurisdiction cases that we have in our brief, it doesn't always have the word on. And nonetheless, you'll see in those cases, they talk about that something is not converted from a residential property to a commercial property just because money is involved. And that gets to, I mean, we do have two sides of the ledger here. We have the residential and we have the commercial. And then obviously we're moving back and forth depending on the example.
Right. Okay, but so then what if the restrictive covenant said there shall be no commercial use of the property? Instead of on the property, no commercial use of the property. Would short-term rentals fall under that prohibition?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because what you're doing is looking at the use on the property itself, and that use is residential use. And it's the eating and the drinking and all of that.
We're looking at the use on the property because that's what this covenant says. But what if it doesn't use on the property? We're substituting that. No commercial use of the property. Right?
Well, I think that's a hard case to say because, you know, you don't exactly know. It's kind of out of thin air, but I guess the argument I have here is I can't separate it from the property itself and what's happening there, given what all these cases do, like Heath, like Harding and the foreign jurisdiction cases, and that's, you know, what's happening on the property. So we have the word on that makes the focus all the more clearer here, but nonetheless, when you back it up, you're still looking at the property itself and what's happening on the property, and I don't think you can divorce the inquiry from what's going on there.
See, I thought that might be the reason that this would be different from, say, a hotel. Right? That's commercial use of the property. You know?
Well, if you want to do it that way, that'd be great for me. But but I think the difference, I think you're still, all of these things come down to exactly what we've been talking about, which is what is happening on the property. And, I mean, that's what we're enjoying, the use of that property. And the ownership piece is, you know, where the money is being exchanged, but really it's the tenants involved that we're looking at here, or the people who are standing there on the property
Is it the tenants? Could it be? Is the property being used for commercial purposes?
Not here, Your Honor. It's not.
No, I mean, couldn't that be the wording, or couldn't that be the test? I mean, you talk about, and I say you, referring to Justice Kelly. See, words, of course, are everything here, right? I mean, the difference between on the property and of the property, the difference between the property being used for commercial purposes, that all has different potential answers. So every word makes a difference here, right?
And I think that's right, Your Honor. I mean, the problem with commercial use, for instance, is, I mean, all mortgages are commercial use in one shape or form because you've got finances being involved there. Here's what I know from our cases so far. I mean, we know that you have to look at the clear terms, which is why, Justice Bradley, it matters. You know that those terms all make a difference. It's not just one, it's all of them. We also know from our cases that you have to look to what's happening on the property. And so I think it's hard to divorce these words from what's happening on the property itself. We also know that commercial activity has a lot of different meanings, and that just doesn't cut it when you're trying to enforce something over a period of time here. And so I think what's happening is when you look at the cases and when you look at the foreign jurisdictions, they're really looking to see, you know, is it a situation where you've got people coming and dealing with bait, or you have people dealing with a grocery store, you know, where there's this mercantile exchange. And then when you look at the other things that are going on in the property, are you looking at somebody sleeping there, eating there? And it's a restaurant, so you have somebody eating there, but you don't have somebody sleeping there. You have that situation where you've got one of the services being provided, but not all. So I guess the bottom line is it is hard to divorce what the actual terms of this covenant are from what is being asked to be enforced. And it's our position, Your Honors, that it is unambiguous here that short-term stays and rentals are not prohibited by the terms of the covenant. Were Your Honors to find that it's hard to figure out at this point what commercial activity is, frankly, you don't have to decide that. You can determine it's ambiguous. And then again, you reach the same result, the one we're asking for here, which is that the Court of Appeals should be affirmed.
The question you pose is a collapse or a joining of the two questions that were set forth in the petition for review for which we accepted review. The first question is the petition for review. I don't have it immediately in front of me, but is this commercial activity? I can get it in a second, I think, is the first question. And the second question, then, the first one, is short-term rental of real estate commercial activity? That's our petition for review question. What's the answer to that?
I'm sorry, is short-term rental of real estate commercial activity?
Yes.
Not on the property, Your Honor, and no. And Your Honor, it is our position it's not.
And the second question that we have for petition for review, again, we can collapse the questions together into one question, as I hear you doing, but the second one, is commerce defined by where a customer remits payment, which seemed to be the thesis of paragraph 13 of the Court of Appeals opinion?
And I think, let me be clear about answering that, and the answer is no. And I think with regard to what we're doing here, this is where I think if you're looking at what's happening at the owner situation, where there was an exchange of payment in some way, shape, or form, that's not what the inquiry is intended to be under the case law. You're really supposed to be looking at what the tenant use is. And so where the commerce happens, or where the exchange of money happens in this situation is not necessary to get to the end result, which is what's the nature of the use. There you look at the tenant. And I think the foreign jurisdictions help with that, too, as does Heath and Harding.
Is there anything else in the Court of Appeals opinion that you would disagree with as far as their reasoning? Because I think they relied quite extensively on the lack of any exchange of money on the property.
No, I think the Court of Appeals, you know, had a solid inquiry here. And I think it's, you know, frankly, from our position, we think that because words like owner, occupied, and leasing are not in the covenant terms, that means that they are not unambiguously prohibited, and they didn't go there as much as we wanted. They ended up with an ambiguous covenant, but the end result is what it should be, which is that it should not be enforced. And if I could just say with regard to what's happening at the owner level, I think that's why this 1031 exchange doesn't really, it's not directed in the right place, because what it's looking at is what's motivating the purpose of the owner, and that's not what is happening with regard to how the restrictive covenant should be defined. You really need to look at what's on the property itself and the use of the property. And that's why we've mentioned in our brief there are a number of things that don't seem to go to the use of the property, and 1031 is one of those.
Well, you link that up in your brief to the phrase commercial activity on the property. And
right.
That is why you are holding on as a drowning man would a piece of wood to the activity on the land.
Exactly. But I think it's also, I mean, this
I don't mean to paint it in such an unfortunate light, but it shows why you're tying it, why you're tethering your argument so closely to what's going on to use Justice Abrahamson's emphasis on the word on the property.
That's right. But I think that even if they folks weren't as lucky as we are to have that in this covenant, I think that when you look at cases like Keefe and Harding, the focus is what's happening there in the house, in the dwelling, in the residence. And so all of those things, I mean, what is the tenant person in the house doing? What are they doing when they step in the shoes of the owner? They're eating, sleeping, recreating. So I think that's the piece.
What else would it be?
Well, you could, as you yourself mentioned, you could be stepping in as a short-term rental and selling bait and tackle out of it.
No, I mean, sorry. There's any number of universe of fact patterns that it could be. What I meant was, what else would our inquiry be when the phrase is commercial activity on the premises?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it should be anywhere else. I think it should be what's happening with the use of the property.
I understand. I understand that, but I guess I'm asking your opposing counsel if she wants to take that into consideration on rebuttal as well. What else would our consideration be?
Your Honor, I think on the property, and that's the biggest part that I think with regard to the Court of Appeals decision that really stands out, which is they really looked to see what was on the property. For those reasons, Your Honor, we respectfully request that you affirm the Court of Appeals decision. Thank you.
Rebuttal?
Thank you. Yes, I think I'll start by responding to the question just posed by Justice Gableman. The inquiry should be not on what the activity is, but whether somebody is paying to engage on it on the lot. I can watch a DVD at home. That's not commercial. I can pay to do it somewhere else.
You were the champion of the plain language of the agreement. So where is that in the plain language of the contract?
It's in the definition of commercial activity. Which is,
then what wouldn't be included? There are so many things that people do in their homes and can do in their homes, especially today's day and age. People have home offices. People sell things on eBay. People babysit and have, you know, children dropped off and babysit in their own homes. They sell Mary Kay. They have all sorts of house parties. And just because money is exchanged at home, here's what troubles me, and you have to help me with this. If I own property, I think there's a presumption that I can do a lot of things with my own property. And if you're going to restrain me from doing things on my own property, it ought to be really clear what I'm prohibited from doing. So where is the clarity in the word commercial activity? It seems so broad to me that it almost is unenforceable.
I would agree that it encompasses a lot, and that is why this community is protected by a restrictive covenant, and the property owners in it relied on those guarantees to prevent certain activity. And if we look at a case like Zinda v. Krause, activity that contravenes the purpose should be enjoined, and we don't need a listing of everything that we're prohibiting.
Yeah, we're trying to figure out what the purpose is, and we're trying to do that by virtue of the language. You mentioned in the first part of your argument that there is should be read into this an exception for activity that is incidental to ownership, right?
Right, and I'm pulling that from Bubbles v. Dane County.
Okay, so but why? What in the actual language of the covenant tells me that that exception exists?
Nothing in the language of this covenant. That's coming from case law.
Okay, so. We have to concentrate on what the language of the covenant is, right?
Right.
And that's supposed to tell us what is prohibited and what's not. All right, so but let's say that we accept that there is an exception to its coverage for incidents of ownership. The very existence of VRBO suggests that one of the incidents to ownership is the short-term rental of your house.
I would disagree with that, but even if that were the case, Your Honor, Wisconsin, the state of Wisconsin, collects sales tax for this activity. They don't do that for year-long leases. They don't do that for occasionally once a year I want to rent my home on VRBO.
Why would that matter?
Because I think it's illustrative of how this is commercial activity. Sales tax connotates commerce.
The state doesn't limit itself to taxing things that it would call commercial activity. It taxes my property. I don't do anything commercial on my property.
This is a sales tax. This is not a real estate tax. This is a sales tax because a service is being sold.
Right. So, but what my point is, why should I care what the state taxes? Why should that tell me what's commercial and what's not commercial?
I think it's illustrative of the fact that this is commerce. And opposing counsel, when asked the question, are short-term rentals commercial, indicated she believed no. The state of Wisconsin clearly believes yes and taxes them as such.
It can't be just because something's taxed that then it becomes commercial. If I do accounting work or I am a crafter and I like to make things and then go to craft fairs, that just because I have to pay tax on that doesn't turn that activity into prohibited, does it?
I don't think it's determinative. I just think it's illustrative. I think it helps illustrate that this is commercial activity, and it would be inconsistent to say commercial activity is not occurring here in the repeated short-term rental of this lot to large groups, but the state of Wisconsin is going to collect a sales tax for it anyway. I just think that's an inconsistency that can't stand. But turning to Zinda v. Krause and the question of activity that contravenes the purpose of the covenant should be prohibited, we don't have here a year-long lease of one family that might look a lot like any other situation, any other residential situation. We have a new party every week with a huge group of people who are ready to cut loose and have a good time in a neighborhood they don't know and they have no connection to. That's very different from somebody who is staying at the property for a year because they have a year-long lease. That's very different than a property owner. It's repeated strangers coming through the neighborhood, driving down this tiny drive past all of these homes with a lot of traffic, lots of cars, trailers, and noise. That's what's happening. It looks like many other businesses with hundreds of customers a year making tens of thousands of dollars. That's commercial activity. It looks like it. It acts like it. It is commercial activity, and we just ask that this court enforce this covenant and protect these property owners and their expectations on this property.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your arguments. It's an interesting property question about what can you do or what can't you do with property given the restrictive covenant at issue. We are going to take a break now and